Hi, I'm Sam Canduff, and this is Decoding Cultural Leadership. Welcome to our podcast, where we explore the intersection between culture and society and interrogate what it really means to be a cultural leader in the 21st century. Each episode, we talk to some of the most influential organizational leaders, creators, policymakers, and thought leaders, and we explore their approach to shifting the dial in a complex, constantly changing world. So, let's dive into today's episode, and together, let's decode cultural leadership. My guest on today's episode of Decoding Cultural Leadership is renowned barrister, author, human rights activist, social justice advocate, and advocate for prisoners' rights, so much more, Greg Barnes, SC. Greg's someone I've known for quite some time. We're both part-time residents of Tasmania, and we share very similar views on orchestral music and the role of orchestral music in driving social change. Greg talked about how music has been such a powerful and driving force in his own life and how he sees music as playing a huge role in public debate, reform and dialogue. We touched on some of the controversial debates that were actually taking place right at that time, particularly about the voice of cultural institutions and artists in discussions of the war in the Middle East and the role and the rights of artists to articulate public positions on these divisive issues. Greg talks about another area of passionate interest, prisoners' rights, and how cultural experiences and music in jails can be very, very powerful forces. As Julian Assange's longtime legal advisor, Greg shares how the cultural community can contribute to the quest for his release. So please enjoy this conversation with Greg Barnes.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. No, it's a great pleasure. And we should say, look, I think we've known each other for probably maybe four or five years now.
Maybe more.
Maybe longer. Yeah. You're a resident of Tasmania, as am I. And, we've caught up many times down there. And so I really wanted to have you on because, for many reasons, Greg, I mean, you know, you've been such a presence, in our cultural conversations across so many, you know, various different issues that you've been so passionate about and continue to be. Right before we talked today, you were taking a media interview with another source and talking about a burning issue today. And this has been a constant thing ever since I've known you, that you've had this kind of involvement with many different issues. And of course, the topic of what we're talking about today is this idea of cultural leadership in Australia. And I know one of the areas that you're really passionate about, which maybe a lot of people might not know, is classical music. So can you just tell me a little bit about what's classical music meant to you in your life?
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up with it. My parents were great classical music lovers. I went to concerts as a young kid. I remember going to the Melbourne Symphony because I grew up in Melbourne. Classical music has been part of my life really since I was probably 4 or 5 years of age, because as I say, I grew up with it. It's an important part of my life because, one, it says so much about our world, and, you know, composers are generally fascinating people. Secondly, you know, the great musicians, you know, the great artists, the great orchestras, you know, again, sort of emblematic of the way in which various societies work. There's also, I mean, I find classical music extraordinarily relaxing, sometimes comforting, sometimes confronting. So, you know, you go through the gamut of emotions.
Yeah, and you've talked before about how you'll listen to classical music as a way of kind of processing thoughts, and when you're thinking about, you know, some of these big cases or some of the things that you're working on.
I do. I mean, I listen to classical music quite a lot in my chambers. And I actually these days I subscribe to Adagio, which is a very, very good classical music sort of Spotify, if you like. But it's excellent. And so you can delve into all sorts of works, and depending on your mood. I mean, the other day, for example, I was listening to working on something that was rather arduous and boring. So I had Maurizio Pollini doing late Chopin. And I mean, he's just such an aristocrat and just perfect music for the occasion.
That's beautiful. And that's the thing, is that you can, you know, you find the right piece of music that is going to fit, you know, whatever you might be doing. Mm. And you mentioned there, which I think was a really good point, is about the kind of grounding of various composers and classical works in kind of social moments or in society in general. And this is something that we've talked about before, is the kind of the relevance. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, classical music, it's a heritage art form. It's, you know, it's, you know, it's dead white male music. You know, we've heard those kind of accusations before. But I know you're kind of the view that there's classical music is more than relevant in society. How do you feel about that now in terms of, you know, contemporary Australian society and the relevance of classical music?
Well, it enriches the society. It is the greatest art form in terms of music because it's the most complex. It's the one that lasts. And, of course, orchestras and chamber music ensembles and individual musicians are key members of our communities in terms of social capital. I mean, for example, I went to a terrific concert down in Kettering, south of Hobart, the other day, Sam, that three musicians, chamber musicians, two of whom are Australians who are now in European orchestras, I think, but it was packed. And what was interesting about it was that it was packed with a lot of people who live in the area, but also I noticed quite a lot of retirees there. Now, that's important, because, you know, that's a focal point for that community to bring those people together, and they can engage before and after the concert, get enriched by the concert. So, and then, of course, with you know, predictions about classical music dying off, you know, these are predictions that have been made, you know, for 50 years, and they never come to fruition, because a bit like Test cricket, it's the ultimate form of its genre. And therefore, you know, people gravitate to it at whatever age.
Yeah, exactly. It's people find it, you know, at different stages in their lives, isn't it? It's a really interesting thing.
Yeah. I mean, I have people, you know, I had somebody recently say to me that they love Wagner, and I didn't even know they like classical music. And we chatted about Wagner, and they were quite, you know, they'd started reading about it, and they said, it was only a few years ago I started listening to it. I had somebody recently who I know had sent me an email saying, I heard Bellini's Norma. I don't know anything about Bellini or Norma. You know, where can I listen to it? So I sent them the Adagio link. But, you know, people who you don't think are going to engage in classical music, or you don't perceive them as engaging in classical music, they are, and they get enriched by it, and then they delve deeper into it.
Yeah, it's true, and you've talked a lot about that kind of, you know, breaking down some of those barriers.
Yeah.
We might call it imposter syndrome or threshold anxiety that a lot of arts organisations have to tackle, you have to think about.
Yeah, they do, and it's really important for classical music to have new audiences. So last year I went to the Adelaide Symphony, but not a traditional concert. It was terrific. It was on a Saturday afternoon. It was in a what I think was an old department store or a pub, and you could walk in. It was only an hour. They played a number of works, no clapping between works, no clapping before or after. It was a chamber ensemble, and people could either lie on a yoga mat if they wanted to, on a beanbag, sit in a chair, stand up. And I noticed the people there, I mean, I'd say 70 or 80% were under 30. Was terrific. Now, that's an experience for them. They may not go across the road to where the ASO plays there on North Terrace, but they'll certainly go to a concert like that.
Yeah, and that experiential kind of idea of presenting concerts is so important. I think it's often, like, I know, I mean, certain you know, writers and theorists have discussed this idea of a pipeline in classical music, and often I think classical organisations think, oh, we'll start someone off with, you know, kids' concerts, and then we'll move into this type of concert, and then we'll move to, and eventually, you know, it's sort of a pathway to subscription. But I think they miss the point sometimes. That,
well, I mean, you know, you can take anyone to a concert and listen to a Mozart symphony. If they knew nothing about classical music, they'd still be engaged by it. Because, I mean, it's a bit like taking people to a gallery, you know, of really great art. You know, people may not go to galleries ever and have no interest in art, but they go to the Louvre, or they go to one of the great London galleries, or even the NGV, you know, here. And they say that was a great experience. You know, I don't normally go to art galleries, but that was a great experience. Now, we don't do it in art galleries. People plunge in, you know, particularly with a blockbuster exhibition. So why do we do it in classical music? Say, oh, well, let's start you there. I mean, I just find it a bit patronising. I think we say to people, come along. You're going to be enriched. You're going to be wowed by this. experience and, you know, be prepared to be wowed by it.
Mm.
And, it, you know, whether it's Shostakovich or Mozart or, you know, one of the operas, you know, people do get enriched by it. They don't have to have a base knowledge to be enriched by something that's so sensual.
And you, and Greg, you've lived and worked in various different parts of Australia. You still do. You have chambers around the country, and you've been involved at a governance level with certain organisations over the years. And you obviously consume a lot of live music. How do you think Australian orchestras are doing with that idea of democratising classical music or bringing people in through the door?
Well, I think it varies from orchestra to orchestra. I mean, I was really impressed with what I saw at the ASO. I only saw that because I thought I was in Adelaide for a Saturday night at a loose end, and I thought, I wonder if there's an ASO concert on, and that's how I found it. So I wrote to Colin Cornish, the CEO originally, and said, great idea. I've suggested it to the TSO. One of my friends is now on the board there. I've suggested it to the TSO. So, you know, these are really easy ideas when you think about it. I mean, it's a no-brainer. You know, it's clever, but in some ways it's a no-brainer. I think each orchestra is different. I'm not familiar enough, Sam, to say, you know, Queensland's doing it better than WA, but I think most of the Australian orchestras have realised that they've got to get new audiences, and it's the way in which they execute that particular strategy which is really important. But what they can do is learn from what happens overseas. I recently sent an article around to various people. I should have sent it to you, actually. I don't think I did, but it was an article by I think it's Joseph Horowitz, who's a very famous American writer on music, and it was about either the North Dakota or South Dakota Symphony. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah, really interesting article. Yeah. So what they're doing is bringing in the Indigenous, you know, the First Nations people of South Dakota, performing works, composing works, and really opening up the orchestral experience in that state.
Hmm.
For a whole new audience, and in particular in that case, you know, First Nations people.
And this is something that we've talked about before, and you know, I'm really passionate about this idea of cultural institutions being sort of super connected to their environments and that what's happening in those environments and the connections that they have with their communities. And that's a really good example. And it's something that we're sort of seeing, you know, happening, you know, I think really very well here in Australia, that we're sort of starting to really open up those dialogues and this whole idea of cultural leadership. This takes me to, this is another sort of focus of this podcast, is I guess really thinking about where arts and cultural institutions intersect with these issues of social change and what role they play in society. So I wonder if you've got a broad view on that.
I do. I noticed an article recently in The Australian, surprise, surprise. I think a musician or somebody who had a connection to the orchestra who was objecting to, I think it was the SSO, making a statement about the voice. I made the point. In a tweet, Beethoven would have thought it was totally appropriate. I think you and I discussed this.
We did.
It would have thought it was totally appropriate. And I think you actually wrote something about it, and rightly. You know, orchestras are part of society. You know, a lot of culture is political and politically driven. I don't mean party political, but it's politically driven. And, of course, classical music. You know, you think Shostakovich and the Leningrad Symphony, you think Beethoven and the Eroica, you think of perhaps more controversially, but certainly Wagner. You know, list the great Hungarian champion. I'll stop in a minute, but you know, Dvořák and Smetana, great champions of the Czech idea of Czech independence. Sibelius, of course, the great hero of independence in Finland. This is politics, and it's important for cultural institutions to take a stand because they perform music that took a stand. So, you know, for them to then sit back and say, oh, well, we can't be involved in that. I think when it comes to human rights issues in particular, they have an obligation to take a stand. And I would say to take a progressive stand, because I don't think there's much classical music that we play that celebrates reaction.
So true, Greg. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. That with that particular piece that you're talking about, I was really shocked to read that one, because it was about, well, it was sort of idea that, oh, people have paid money to be there. And
yeah, leave your politics at the door.
It's so strange.
It's odd. I mean, let's say you're playing Beethoven's Eroica and you say to people, let's leave your politics at the door. Well, that's all right. We'll listen to it in here. But that's okay because it was 200 years ago, you know.
Yeah, somehow in classical music we have this sort of detachment from context, and
yeah.
We have to sort of keep it in this kind of like a glass jar, and it has to be this sort of sacred thing. But of course, you know, all this music was written for various different formats. Some of it was written to be performed in bars, and some of it was for outdoor. Some of it was to be performed on board barges and boats and that kind of thing.
Well, and some of it, Sam, was for political purposes in the sense that, you know, composers like Mozart had patrons who were, you know, various princes and counts, etc. And the promotion of music by these people was part of their leadership. So, you know, I mean, again, it's politics in that broader sense.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what you've just connected, that idea of cultural leadership that we're really exploring on Decoding Cultural Leadership. So I want to just, you know, talking about you and your own involvement with several really, you know, burning kind of issues that have taken place over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years. And you've been at the cusp of some incredibly powerful movements. And one of them would be, you know, 23 years ago or so now, the Australian Republic movement and the referendum. And what role did culture play in that, in arts and culture?
We had quite a lot of artists who were involved in the campaign. We also had sports people. I'm trying to think. It's a while ago now, Sam, but we certainly had from sort of rock music, art. Tom Keneally, for example, the writer, very passionate about the Republic. We had some classical musicians from memory, and it was about saying, you know, culture reflects and should reflect independence. You know, and so people were drawn to that idea. I mean, you know, that's why, for example, you know, we've encouraged Australian composers over the years, and we've had some terrific Australian composers. But all of them in recent years, Sculthorpe, Ross Edwards, etc., have sought to strike out a very Australian idiom, or strike out on their own with a very Australian idiom. And that fitted and fits within the idea of a republic.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a moment, I guess, of, you know, if you think about cultural pride, but becoming, you know, identity, nation building, that kind of language that we saw used around that time. And obviously, you know, a time to think about how do we contextualize this.
Well, it was just after, you know, it was 5 years after Paul Keating's Creative Nation, of course, the great statement. And of course, Keating got, in the way no other political leader in this country has got, he got the importance of culture for nation building. Sadly, we haven't seen that repeated by any of our leaders.
Decoding Cultural Leadership is supported by Limelight, and the May 2024 issue of Limelight is now available online and in print. And as ever, it's packed with news, features, and reviews. This month's issue explores the power of Puccini and why his operas are so popular a century after his death. It takes a look at Umberto Clerici's rapid rise from cellist to chief conductor, and the phenomenal Sarah Brightman's return to Australia in Sunset Boulevard. Limelight, Australia's dedicated music, arts, and culture platform. Please head over to their website, limelight-arts.com.au, and find out how you can start accessing Limelight's excellent content today. It certainly that was a moment when that Creative Nation came out. It was just a, you know, incredible, you know, milestone for our cultural life, wasn't it? Really,
absolutely,
And of course, Keating is a friend of yours and a colleague.
Well, I know him. It'd be too much to say he's a friend, but he's been very good to me over the years. I've chatted with him about various issues, and he, of course, has a great passion for the Sydney Symphony Orchestra in particular. And I know he's been pretty concerned about the SSO in recent years, but he. He has a great love of classical music. I think his genre is, I don't mean any disrespect to Keating by saying this, is relatively narrow. I've never heard him talk about chamber music or opera, but he certainly loves the symphonic form from sort of, you know, Beethoven onwards.
It's a lot of Mahler in there.
A lot of Mahler, a lot of Shostakovich.
Yeah.
But also I think a great lover of Beethoven. And he used to buy his CDs at a place called Abel's in Canberra, which was a fantastic record store run by a guy called Ross Genjos. Anyway, I was in there one day and I was looking at this Richard Strauss. I think I was looking at this Richard Strauss, the complete orchestral works. And Russell, one of them, said, oh, Keating bought a copy of that. So I said, I'll have one.
That's enough.
And it was, I think it was Rudolf Kemper and the Dresden Orchestra, who was the great exponent of Richard Strauss. I think I've still got it somewhere. Well, most of my listening now is online, but I have got it somewhere.
That's fantastic. Keating's talked about very much about how he uses music to kind of, you know, to process heavy ideas, putting on Mahler, you know, at full blast after a heavy day on Policy.
Absolutely.
So we talked about the Republican movement, and now we fast forward, you know, 20 odd years, and we'll be releasing this podcast sometime in 2024. But as we're speaking, we've just been through another big referendum, another huge referendum with, you know, you've been very vocal about and very much, you know, in favour of a yes vote, which didn't eventuate, you know, much to the sort of disappointment of many of us in our community, I would say. But what's your observation of culture's role in that debate? Do you think we've come further than what you experienced with the Republican referendum, or do you think we're still sort of teetering on the edge with culture, you know, taking a real leadership role on issues of social importance?
Yeah, I think that it was a very disappointing campaign. I mean, sadly, it was the no case was a cut and paste from 1999, cynical, deceptive, and dishonest. And I'm not sure culture played the role that it should play. But I think as a nation, you know, there's been a lack of government leadership on cultural issues. Although I'm told Tony Burke, the new arts minister, is actually pretty passionate about it and very good. I haven't had any dealings with him myself, but we have had a long period where I think the idea that art is part and parcel of the identity of the nation has been missing. And so I think in the Yes campaign, I didn't detect a great sort of cultural shift or, you know, the use of culture in that campaign. I think it came down to, a very cynical political exercise by the no case.
And you've commented on that too, Greg. You said, you know, that the same kinds of strategies and tactics were being used by the
very divisive. I mean, this idea of elites, and, you know, that feeds into culture a bit. So, you know, politicians are scared of going to orchestra, going to symphony concerts. They're scared of talking about it because Keating's love of classical music was used against him by, you know, the cynical opportunists on the right to say, oh, he's an elitist, you know. And it's really, you know, it didn't help, and it hasn't helped breaking down barriers for people in relation to classical music, because, of course, it's anti-elitist. I mean, classical music is the most democratizing of art forms, you know. Anybody can go to a classical music concert. Anybody can buy a CD or listen to it online. Anyone, anywhere in the world can engage with it. And anyone, of course, can learn an instrument and end up being a member of an orchestra. So, you know, it's democratizing influence means that, and it's sort of equalizing influence means that it is should be a very, very important part of the social fabric and the political fabric of a nation.
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. I mean, that notion of classical music being a kind of a document or a living entity, really. It's something that evolves with society, and for some reason we sort of seem to miss that point. We get it with things like Shakespeare.
Correct. I mean, we get it with film, we get it with Shakespeare, we get it with art, but somehow, I mean, for example, as I said, I mean, I think one of the things that galleries have done in Australia is they've got into this blockbuster era, and you understand, I talk to artists and you understand why they do it, because it brings the bucks in. But what it has done is that it has meant you get people in this city, for example, in Melbourne and elsewhere around Australia, say, let's go to the NGV. I want to see the Monet exhibition. They would never go to an art gallery. They would never, and they may not have much art on their walls, but it becomes an experience, right? And That's what we've got to do with classical music. And you don't do it. And the art galleries don't do it by dumbing down. This is, you know, Monet, Manet, Chagall, you know, these are first rate artists. We should be doing it with classical music. And, you know, that, but I think, you know, part of this really starts also in the schools and, you know, culture in, you know, in the generations to come is really important. You know, you got to start it young.
Yeah, I mean, it's so true. And there's been so much research on that, you know, in order to develop a taste for classical music later in life, you've generally got to have some exposure to it.
Well, and you get better educational outcomes. That's, I mean, I've seen work on that. I'm not an expert in that area, but I've seen work in that. There is, if you have music in your school program, you get better educational outcomes.
That's so true, isn't it? Because it you know, and it's been very well proven that the link between cognitive development,
correct,
and all kinds of skills, yeah. And I always, I mean, I know you're a great lover of football, but I as someone who's me personally has never been much of a sports person, but I believe that playing in an orchestra teaches all those kinds of
I mean, teamwork. Mm. You know, what's your role? How do you contribute? You feel worthwhile whether you're playing the tuba or the first violin. You know, you're part of an organic whole. And, you know, and kids love it. Kids love it. I mean, if you go to schools where, you know, they play music, you can see the joy that kids get out of it. And, you know, it ought to be compulsory in schools. I mean, art classes are generally, if they're not compulsory, there's generally a fair bit in those programs in schools. You know, I don't know why we're not doing music in the same way.
Very good point. No, and hopefully that's something that, you know, policy, we'll see that sort of shifting as time goes on, as we sort of re-engage, I guess, reconnect with our cultural life in different ways with this new policy, this new cultural policy. And I'm really hopeful to see the revive policy, to see, you know, what kind of results that nets over the next 5 to 10 years. I think it's an exciting moment for us.
Yeah.
Greg, I just, you know, we're talking about leadership here, and I want to take the shift from, I guess, the broad brush of cultural leadership to leadership in your own life, and you as someone, as I said in the opening segment here, you know, you've been so visible and so kind of vociferous about things that have been important to you and continue to be important to you. What sort of, how do you feel about leadership in your own life and your own role as a leader? If you've been involved with these various different movements and you're not afraid to come out and talk about tough issues where other people might not, how do you frame your own approach to your own leadership, you know, strategies and philosophy?
Well, I think if you believe in an issue and you've got an opportunity to show leadership because of where you are in society, whether you're a lawyer or you're involved in politics or you write, you should take advantage of that. I think it's also important, and I've always been a great believer in, you know, leaders who take risks. And I don't have any formal leadership roles, except I do chair a prisoner's legal service in Tasmania. But, you know, leaders who take a risk and leaders who are prepared to kick, you know, not kick, to run against the grain, they're the leaders you should admire. I'm not talking about populism here. I'm talking about leaders who put policy first or who put the ideals first and don't diminish water down those ideals in order to get advantage. Now, I think that, you know, that some of the issues I've been involved in, human rights issues, particularly issues around policy reform in governments, they've become a bit unfashionable because we live sadly in a 24/7 media environment where it's difficult. It's become difficult for politicians, most of whom don't have spines. But it's an easy way out for them. You know, oh, it's all too hard. Let's put it in the too hard basket. And, you know, real leadership, as Keating showed, as Whitlam showed, real leadership comes from taking those big risks, you know, and shifting the dial, as it were.
Mm. Do you think you'd ever step back into a formal political role again?
Not a chance.
No.
Why would I? You know, I mean, you know, politics... I think politics these days is pretty degrading. You know, I saw this week in Tasmania, for example, mandatory sentencing, to which most lawyers are fundamentally opposed, which is for your listeners, setting a courts are required to send people for jail for certain periods of time, whether it's just or not. And the Labor Party in Tasmania had opposed the government's proposal on three occasions. And on this occasion, they just flipped. And I think, you know, that is an example of seeking base political advantage whilst jettisoning, you know, fundamental principles of the rule of law. And that's appalling.
And I mean, all these things that you've talked about, like the 24-hour news cycle, this sort of short attention span that we have now, has really shifted that discourse, hasn't it?
Well, it's really, and people don't remember. I mean, if you say to people, in fact, I was talking to a journalist recently about compensation for those asylum seekers who the High Court has recently said cannot be detained indefinitely, and so they've been held unlawfully, and now they can bring what are called false imprisonment claims. And this journalist was saying, well, this is outrageous. It's going to cost the taxpayer. I said, don't you recall that this policy of locking up asylum seekers has cost successive governments hundreds of millions of dollars? And I said, you know, there was a huge class action settlement only 5 years ago for $70 million. Oh, I've forgotten that. And that's the problem, that it's such a shift. And I don't blame the journalist, but, you know, he said, oh, yeah, I'd forgotten that. You know, so, people don't sort of – the narrative now doesn't include memory. It tends to be about the here and now.
And I tend to think – I know, I sort of feel that we've lost the art of discourse, the actual art of having – public conversations, you know, respectfully. We've seen this kind of, this horrible kind of fragmentation of media, and now we've got this massive divide between the left and the right, and we've seen the results of things like cancel culture and social media pylons. So you're either afraid to articulate a position, or when you do articulate a position, there's not proper discussion or debate.
No, I'm partly guilty sometimes of that, I think, in intemperate social media posts. But you're right. And of course, the rise of Trumpism, but also the populist right in Europe. I mean, the AfD, which is a hard right party in Germany now, is, you know, running second in the polls. Don't think, you know, as a very wise old friend of mine said once, don't think democracy is compulsory. You know, it doesn't have to be a democracy. And if you let it slide, it won't be a democracy. And you do just see now a degree of dangerous authoritarianism, but also overt racism, which never went away, but is now more overt. And you saw that during the Yes campaign. And you're also seeing a sort of dumbing down of culture not only a dumbing down, you're also seeing a cancel culture. I mean, it's extraordinary. In the United States, you've got parents pulling books off shelves. I mean, this is sort of medieval stuff or Victorian stuff. You know, and no doubt there'll be, you might know better than me, Sam, but Wagner, for example, was never played in Israel for a long time until Baron Boehm broke that back in the 90s. But, you know, when the Russians went into Ukraine, you had orchestras cancelling Tchaikovsky, you know, or refusing to program Russian musicians. I mean, it's outrageous. You know, what we do is we conflate issues, and we're doing it a little bit at the moment. As we talk at this point in time, we have this terrible Middle Eastern issue, Gaza issue. And what you're seeing, if you're pro-Palestinian, so often some in the media and your critics will say, well, you're anti-Semitic and you support Hamas. It's this constant conflation of you stand for this, therefore you stand for that. And that's because we don't have discourse. You know, we don't have discourse. What we have is shouting at each other, as you say.
Everything becomes a zero-sum game.
A zero-sum game and reductionist all the time, you know.
It has all kinds of negative effects, I think, because people then are afraid to speak up, or they form an opinion that's formed on a very shallow basis, and we end up with a discussion that really has no kind of validity.
And people get harassed. I know of one young professional, I won't say much more than that, but who rang me recently because they'd put a post up about the Gaza conflict, and it was pro-Palestinian, and they had the senior boss in the firm ring them on a weekend and say, I want to see you Monday morning. I've had a client complain. I mean, honestly, you know, instead of saying to the client, hey, we believe in freedom of speech, that's a core value of our firm, you know, this sort of reactive strategy that's used and you know, but it's also, you know, the attacks on people like orchestras and in the corporate sector, you know, organisations that do support progressive causes, there's a pile on from the right, you know, how dare they do this, and this has become, you know, political correctness and all these ridiculous slogans get thrown around. It's depressing.
It is depressing. And like, I think actually as we speak, we're seeing a real tussle in the arts community because we're seeing, you know, some very polarizing views, and it's having ramifications with, you know, various corporate partners and you know, and partnerships where, you know, the views are sort of, you know, coming up against each other and statements by the organizations.
Well, we saw it again in the context we're talking. Arnold Bloch Leibler, which is a major law firm and the senior partner of which is extremely pro-Israel, pulled funding from a project in Collingwood, just pulled the funding.
Collingwood Yards.
Yeah. We've seen. I know you were going to ask me about it, so I'll answer it for you. NAVA, which is the National Association of Visual Arts, I was on their board for about 7 years, 20 years ago. You know, there was a letter, an open letter from NAVA members or the board, and led to somebody resigning because they didn't like it. I mean, the nature of democracy is that we put up with, and in fact, we should embrace the alternate view. There are limits, of course. I mean, there are limits on freedom of speech. I mean, if I came out and said, you know, that all Aboriginal people are, you know, got low IQs or something, that's just unacceptable, right? Because it's inciting hatred. But within the discourse of something that's as controversial as the actions of Israel in Gaza, you've got to expect that people will take a stand, and they should take a stand, and artists should take a stand, because it's the antithesis of the values of art to be wiping out entire communities and bombing hospitals and you know, populations being displaced. That is the antithesis of the values of art. And so artists do have a role in calling it out.
Absolutely.
And writing about it and painting it and playing it.
I couldn't agree more. And my view, I mean, I feel, and this is something, I don't know, I've talked about it a little bit before, but I think the role of cultural organizations, cultural institutions, our orchestras, our operas, our galleries, ballet companies, etc., they provide a platform or a space, at least, for those conversations to take place.
Absolutely.
You know, articulating a view is absolutely, but also a safe space or a neutral space for some of those ideas to be worked out. That's how we kind of progress and move forward as a society.
Correct. I totally agree. And you know, for example, I think one of the clever ideas, you know, if you're and we've improved on this in recent years, if go back to Beethoven's Eroica, you know, it would be a good idea sometimes, depending on the context, for people to have a discussion about that music, what it meant, what it means in terms of Beethoven's idea of liberty and freedom, his disillusionment with Napoleon because he became autocratic and moved back into became an emperor, and you know, what does that say about today? So put it in context and ask ourselves those questions.
Hi, it's Sam. A quick interruption to this episode to ask if you've caught up with earlier episodes of Decoding Cultural Leadership. We release episodes every Monday at 8 a.m. Subscribe on your favourite platform so you can access new conversations hot off the press. Dive into our back catalogue to uncover a wealth of powerful conversations with some of the most dynamic thinkers, trailblazers and innovators in the cultural world. People like Michael Lynch.
It's been an incredibly lucky career in terms of some of the steps and even some of the missteps that I've taken.
Fiona Allen.
From early days, I wanted to be making a contribution.
Wesley Enoch.
What leadership is where you could actually stand by your values and keep talking in a persuasive way.
Louise Herron.
It's been wild, all-consuming, wild, massive, but brilliant. I've loved it. And so challenging and so ever-changing.
Claire Spencer.
how you hope that that institution will leave its fingerprints.
And Yarmila Alfonsetti.
It is a privilege to do what we do. It is an absolute privilege. And people had better be on their toes.
And keep connected for upcoming episodes featuring Richard Evans, Megan Burslem, Brian Ritchie, Greta Bradman, Nayara, and a host of other stellar guests. Subscribe now and embark on a journey of discovery, exploring new perspectives and deepening your appreciation for the arts and cultural leadership. Decoding Cultural Leadership, Culture, Society, Conversations. Presented in association with Limelight.
That conversation is fascinating, isn't it? When you think about, you know, the historical, that like the genesis of and the provenance of those works and those positionings of those composers and how that all kind of, you know, coalesced. I had a wonderful colleague who, you know, well in Tasmania, who Robert Gibson, who would always talk about this fantastic historical background to the works and the program, and bring that into the program, the communication about the concerts. And I think that's something the orchestras need to sort of, you know, as you say, bring those conversations.
And you know, maybe you know, what you do is you have a concert where all you're playing is the Eroica. But before it, you have a panel discussion, which people can engage in.
Yeah, exactly. And that's. I mean, I think that should be sort of.
And then enriches the music because they start to listen to it from a different perspective.
So true, Greg. So switching to another, you know, just you've mentioned already your involvement with prisoners' rights, and this is something that you've been incredibly involved with for a long period of time, and very vocal about that. Can you see a role for the arts, for the cultural industries to be intersecting with this issue and making a difference?
I sure can. In the UK, there have been some fabulous music programs, partly because there's quite a large Caribbean cohort within prisons, and so they love music. And there's a trust over there. I can't remember the Lady Taylor Trust or something like that. Has put a lot of money into these programs and they've been really successful. I think some orchestras, members of orchestras have gone into prison. I think there is a greater, you know, we haven't done it in Australia. There may be some isolated examples, but I'm not aware of them. But not only that sort of art, visual arts, I think, have done it a bit more.
Mm.
And in fact, they have, because every year the Tasmanian Prison Service puts on an art show of the works of prisoners. So visual art has done it, music less so, but we ought to be doing it because, you know, and I'm not necessarily talking about classical music, but, you know, having any forms of music and the opportunity for, you know, for orchestras to play or for rock bands or jazz groups, you know, to be in prisons, again, is part of a major part of the rehabilitation process of prisons.
Mm. Yeah,
well, I mean, I know that I did have a prison officer who was actually a pretty decent bloke, said to me once, the problem is, Greg, got security issues about instruments. He said, we don't want one prisoner beating another prisoner over the head with a violin. I said, I get it. But I said, on the other hand, you supply paintbrushes and easels and you can pick up an easel. And yeah, you know, we got into this terrible discussion about security of art forms.
Potter's wheels. I can imagine that.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, certainly one of the projects that I was the most, you know, fortunate to be involved with during my time at the TSO was that Convict Monologues program. Wonderful Jenny Compton, who conceived and put that together with Paul McIntyre, going into the Tasmanian prison.
I remember you did. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah.
Great program.
That was a terrific program. Mm, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And prisoners writing scripts, writing about that. Yeah. But it was all messages about hope and rehabilitation and you know, coming back into society and then original music and just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful project.
Yeah.
Just, and you know, I won't keep you too much longer, Greg. You've been really generous with your time as you always are.
That's all right.
But it'd be remiss of me not to ask you about Julian Assange and your longstanding involvement with Julian and with WikiLeaks and where are we and where are we heading with this long-standing challenging situation?
Well, I mean, you know, this is a case which is about a core value, freedom of the press, and about the right of people to know what's happening in democracy. The case is at a sort of inflection point because we're waiting for a UK court to decide whether or not he can appeal against the latest decision, which was a rejection. We've also, though, there's been enormous pressure now going on the US and the Biden administration. We know that this Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has raised the issue. But, you know, one of the aspects of this that's disappointing is that you know, he's Mr. Albanese's now said that, you know, President Biden said, I won't interfere with the Department of Justice. But, of course, he's got a pardon power, and people don't understand that the president can pardon a person even if they're just charged with a criminal offence. They don't actually have to have been found guilty. So there is a capacity to give clemency to Julian. And it should happen. I mean, he's got a wife and two young kids. He wants to, you know, he's often talked about coming back to Australia. He's got family in Australia. His father, John Shipton, and his brother, Gabriel, have been amazing. They did an extraordinary documentary called Ithaca,
mm-hmm.
which has been shown around the world. And we are ramping up the pressure. We've now got a parliamentary group, which is cross-party, people from Barnaby Joyce through to the Greens. We had, I think, about 70 MPs sign a letter that went to the United States recently. So there is now real pressure, and I think public pressure, to bring this matter to an end, and it should. Mm. So, the time is opportune, but it does rely on, I think, Australia really putting, you know, the alliance on the line to say, you know, we've given you everything. AUKUS, you know, we do your policing job on China and the region. You know, we're your best friend. This has got to be delivered.
Mm. What would you say to the cultural community about how the artists of Australia, how would they support this?
Well, they have been supporting it. They have been supporting it, and there's been some fantastic support by the arts community for Julian Assange, as there has by some very prominent journalists like Kerry O'Brien and others. We encourage the arts community to continue to raise it. And as I say, they have done so and they continue to do so.
And Paul Grabowski, who I'll be speaking to shortly for this podcast, is with Vince Jones, written a fantastic piece of music. I don't know if you've
Dear
Julian.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. No, look, there's been some terrific work by musicians both here and overseas, and particularly in the UK and the US, but particularly in the UK.
Fantastic, Greg. Thank you so much. Final question to you then. Just this is I guess going back to your knowledge of orchestras and their connection with society and their connection with culture, and not just orchestras, but cultural life in Australia. What do you think? What would you say needs to change? Where do we need to shift the dial to get more connected?
Yeah, I think you got to keep opening the doors. You know, I think the era of 8 o'clock concerts is probably diminishing. Doing things like I was talking about earlier, the ASO is doing it, really important. And learning from each other about what works. I mean, what might work in Cleveland, for example, may not work in Hobart. But, you know, you can say, yeah, well, there's a germ of an idea and we can tweak it this way and that. But I think also they've got to be much more engaged in conversations in the community, not just on the arts pages of a newspaper or in the media, but, you know, more broadly, talking about the intersection between arts and broader social issues. So there's that. And you can do that. You know, people say, oh, that's diminishing the art. It's not. It's actually enriching conversations. I'd like to see their profile lifted in communities. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, Sam. Football, AFL football clubs, and the AFL's been really good at this in building, you know, football clubs into the communities. There's an opportunity there, I think, for orchestras and cultural organisations to link with football clubs. I know that the WASO and the West Coast Eagles had an arrangement. This is going back 20 years now. I'm not sure if it's still going, where, you know, you could, if you're a member of the WASO, I think you got two games, Eagles games and vice versa, something like that. But, you know, there's no reason why, you know, there can't be linkages between, you know, they're all forms of entertainment at one level. They're all forms of recreation at one level, but they're also important institutions within a community. And we've got to break down some of those barriers.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more.
I mean, Poulenc, I think, was a great rugby fan and wrote a piece called Rugby.
Yeah, right.
From memory.
Yeah, I think that's
and,
right.
And, you know, a number of the English composers have been great lovers of cricket, you know, for example.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, we've seen actually in sports writing people who've been able to cross over. I mean, C.L.R. James, the famous West Indian writer who was a Marxist who wrote some fantastic political stuff, but also wrote a very famous book, I think, called Beyond the Boundary. I think that's what it's called, but I might be wrong about that. That might be somebody else. But anyway, he wrote a very famous book on cricket, which you can still get, and weaving politics and cricket together.
Mm.
So, yeah, there are plenty of opportunities there.
see these connections. And we're later on today, I'll be talking to another mutual friend of ours, and I know someone that you have a lot of respect for, Ben Northey.
Well, Benjamin Northey should be the chief conductor of the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. I think he's a fabulous musician, and he's a really decent human being. And he is a person who can really engage with the broader community in the way that he talks about music, and also in the way that he performs. He's a very open sort of conductor. He's very engaged with his audience, and I think, you know, it's becoming part of the institution of culture, in particularly in Victoria.
I couldn't agree more. Well, Greg, you've another fantastic individual, and you've been very generous with your time. Thank you for giving your time.
No, it's a pleasure, Sam. And I think the work you're doing is great and really important, because, you know, communicating this. But I know you've got a strong interest in this sort of cultural leadership, and it does need new voices, but voices who, like yours, have got experience, been there, done that, and say, let's take it to the next level.
Thanks so much, Greg. And look, thanks for your contribution to our national conversation over such a long period of time, which continues, and long may it continue. So thanks for joining us.
No, a pleasure.
Decoding Cultural Leadership. Have a great day, and I'll see you very soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on this edition of Decoding Cultural Leadership. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please consider subscribing via your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. You can even write us a review. You can follow us on Instagram, X, and Threads at DCLPod. That's at DCLPod. You can also write to me at sc@samuelcandough.com. My huge thanks to creative director Niloufar Pashfarouch, and thanks to our production partners, Limelight, Australia's dedicated music, arts, and culture platform. Please head over to their website, limelight-arts.com.au, to read content related to this podcast. Decoding Cultural Leadership is recorded on the Wurundjeri, Gadigal and Palawa lands, and I acknowledge elders past and present, and the immense privilege of hosting this conversation on lands where cultural leadership has been practiced for millennia before us. My name is Sam Candiff. This is a production of the Institute of Cultural Leadership, and we'll see you next time on Decoding Cultural Leadership.